Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire lawmakers passed the Shoreland Protection Act almost 30 years ago. The goal was simple: keep Granite State lakes and rivers clean through regulations on land use along the shoreline. But the law has been challenged over the years. Waterfront property owners have often felt the rules were too strict, or arbitrary, or unclear. And the legislature has responded to those concerns by making changes. However, as state requirements have eased up a bit, some towns have passed their own ordinances to go beyond the state law. So today, there's still some confusion over waterfront development, even though there's wide agreement with the larger goal: clean water for everyone to enjoy. Today in The Exchange, revisiting the Shoreland Protection Act. Let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests in studio. Tom O'Brien is here. He's president of New Hampshire Lakes. Tom, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Jason Obey, Shoreland Program Outreach Coordinator with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Jason, welcome back. Thank you.
Great. Thanks to be back.
And also with us, Jeff Schloss, Natural Resources Chair at UNH Cooperative Extension and co-author of the book Landscaping at the Water's Edge, An Ecological Approach. And Jeff, thank you for being here as well. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
So here's the basic tension, gentlemen, and I'm sure you know this well. New Hampshire waters belong to everyone. To us, the general public, but the property along the water is often privately held. So, Jeff, what are some of the major priorities for shoreland protection? What are we worrying about? What are we asking property owners to worry about?
Well, Laura, virtually everything that we do on the landscape will have some effect on water quality, given the slope and the small amount of drainage areas that all our receiving waters have, lakes, streams, rivers. Even the ocean. So what we're concerned about is that shoreline area is that last place that anything can be done to kind of hold back all of the different types of materials and pollutants and different types of floodwaters or stormwaters that can come in that will essentially impact the water either through water quality or by modifying the habitat of the shoreline, which is an extremely important habitat that we have in New Hampshire.
So the Shoreland Protection Act basically is the last effort to prevent gunk, pollutants, stuff getting into the water.
It is that, yes.
Through a series of requirements that were, you know, for bushes and trees and so forth. To slow things down.
Bottom line, the best thing we can do is kind of put nature in the way of the kind of storm runoff and things that we get. Vegetation is very, very helpful in breaking up the power of raindrops as they hit the ground, in absorbing nutrients before they get to the water.
I love your thoughts too, Jason, on just the fundamental way that the Shoreland Protection Act tries to slow things down so that less stuff runs off into the water.
Sure. I think Jeff touched on it nicely, but really in a nutshell, what you're looking at is a combination of trees, saplings, native shrubs, natural ground covers, that natural system that acts to intercept stormwater and also provide critical wildlife habitat, as well as just maintain the natural aesthetic beauty of our water bodies.
When you say stormwater, just remind us what that is. I think most people know.
Sure.
But
stormwater, you know, some folks would look at it as just dirty water, brown water, but it has all those agents like nitrogen, phosphorus, silt, sediments. Those are the critical components that accelerate the natural aging of our water bodies and have the tendency to significantly decrease water quality.
And we're seeing heavier rainstorms in recent years. So it's one thing if there's a gentle rain all day, right?
Sure.
Jason, it's another thing if all of a sudden water is just dumping out of the sky and it rushes off the pavement into the lake.
Sure, that's right. So we're looking at two pieces here. You know, in New Hampshire, we not only are we impacting our buffers by removing a lot of the natural ground covers and trees and saplings, but over the last decade or so, we're seeing an increase in storm events that produce more than 2 inches of liquid precipitation in a 24-hour period. So that, too, is having an impact on our water quality.
And that's why sometimes after a heavy rainstorm, you try to go to your favorite lake and they say, no, you can't. It's contaminated.
Cyanobacteria, algae blooms,
yeah,
et
cetera. Yeah, this happened
yes.
to me more than once. So, okay. Right. So to you, more broadly, I think, Tom O'Brien, the Shoreland Protection Act, as we've said, has been on the books for almost 30 years, 1991. How much of a difference do you think it's made, Tom?
Well, I think it's made a huge difference. If nothing else, raised awareness amongst landowners, the construction industry, landscape industry, real estate industry, lake advocates, about the importance of that land adjacent to lakes. So I think it's the fact that there may be some creative tension around the ebb and flow of standards relative to the act as they get dialed up or dialed back. Part of it has been a learning process to say, you know, did the standard have the desired effect? Did this percentage that was established for, you know, remaining vegetation have the desired effect? Or did, in fact, people still create virtual bowling alleys of developed lots where runoff can run unimpeded into a lake.
Bowling alleys, that's a good analogy. So that just means an open, smooth lane for all sorts of stuff to
exactly.
be dumped into the lake. I think you're also referring, Tom, to the fact that in the almost 30 years that this has been on the books, the legislature's kind of gone back and forth on this law, haven't they?
Indeed. And I'll give them credit for the process, and that is that there's been, in multiple occasions, a committee or commission, an advisory committee formulated that has legislators, that has the various representatives from industry, from lake advocates, from the agencies. And we've worked in several cases for years as a shoreland advisory committee to try to sort it out so that, in fact, the regulations, the standards are smart, they're going to have the desired effect, and the process, the permitting process is consistently and more easily navigated on the part of applicants.
Oh, and consistency has been a complaint that we've heard over the years that, you know, the Shoreland Protection Act, you know, says this for this case and then, you know, that for that case and that different owners seem to be treated differently. I mean, consistency has been a problem with this.
Yeah, I don't know about people being treated differently so much as there are certainly different conditions. We have 1,000 lakes in New Hampshire that are in the public domain. And those shorelines and those environments are drastically different. You may have sandy shores, you may have rocky shores, you may have steep, you may have relatively low and shallow. And some folks have very different needs. We recognize that, say, someone needs more accessible access to the water, if that's not redundant, ways to get to the water from their home, say, in a wheelchair, or say someone is not as mobile. So the expectation that somehow is kept entirely in a forested condition where they have to clamber down over rocks may not be realistic. So can they make that more accessible for themselves in a way that doesn't affect water quality? We think so. We think that can be done. And I think, frankly, I can't speak for the agency, but they work hard to find a results-based approach. So the end result needs to be that what people do in the landscape doesn't have a negative effect.
Sure. Well, and sometimes it's hard to figure out because people see things and they may not understand some of the subtleties
sure.
that you talk about. I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then there's so much more that we need to talk about. Again, today in the Exchange, we're revisiting the Shoreland Protection Act, and we'd love to hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. If you live near a lake or river in New Hampshire, what questions do you have about landscaping, water quality, development, and what this act says about that? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Jason, I'd love your thoughts, too, on sort of how this act has gone back and forth over the years. Again, passed in 1991, some big changes in 2008, some more changes in 2011. I'm not expecting you to give me all the details of those changes over time, but why do we seem to keep going back and forth and around on this?
Well, I think with any law, with the ebb and flow of the legislature, there are consistently changes, and the legislature is always trying to look at the law and try to strike a careful balance between wise development within the protected shoreline. Certainly, the rights of private property owners is an issue, and also achieving some level of environmental protection. So, over the years, certainly the level of protection within the law has waxed and waned.
My read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, please, is that the original Shoreland Protection Act was sort of dialed back a couple years ago, not quite as tough as it used to be. Is that your assessment?
Well, in short, 2008, a new permitting process took effect, and there were some new limitations with respect to how trees and saplings are managed. That law became weakened a bit in 2012, and just recently last year in 2008, the law was tightened up a bit to actually allow for a more well-distributed stand of trees to be distributed along the first 50 feet of the shoreline.
So changes back and forth. I wonder what you think about this too, Jeff.
Well, we kind of come at this a little bit differently, and even in the non-regulated way, there are some real positives to maintaining different types of landscaping, especially more natural-like landscaping on shorelands. Besides dealing with the water quality aspect, it also helps the biodiversity of the lake itself in terms of the all different types of plants and animals that really inhabit that shoreline area. And there's the tremendous amount of aesthetics. It's some people think that there needs to be a total clearing down to the end, but then they complain that they're getting invasive weeds or that they're getting geese on their lawn or something else. And if they actually kept to a more natural landscape, they'd actually get rid of not only those problems, but also serve the problem that we have of trying to get that last chance at catching a good amount of those pollutants in the runoff and that last chance of not to disturb that critical edge that we see on the shoreline.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the landscaping. And here's a question for all of you. And so to you first, Jeff, from that pure recreational standpoint, a lot of people living along a lake, they want a little beach, you want a view, you want a dock. I mean, if you go online and look at lake vacation rentals, nobody says, come rent our house. It's completely shielded from the lake by trees. So can you do that on the shoreline, underneath the Shoreland Protection Act? Still have that little dock, still have some kind of a beach you can jump in the water, still have some kind of a view of the water?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you don't have to cut a tree down to have a view. You can very carefully limit a tree. You could have an arborist do it or take a look at some recommendations that you can get online and do it yourself and actually cut some really nice view ways. In fact, there's lots of positives to having larger trees on a property in terms of saving on cooling costs and everything else. You can still see the water. In terms of beaches, I won't mention the lake, but I can remember going down to a lake that was complaining that there was actually a wetland growing in this embayment that was right off of where their beaches were. And I'm standing on this humongous sandy beach, and I'm asking them, how many times do you replenish? After how many years do you replenish the sand on the beach? And they're like, well, every year we bring down a couple of truckloads. And I'm thinking, they're not realizing that they're actually bringing down sand, which is then getting eroded away, that is then forming that shallower area, that shoal that they're seeing and complaining about because it's turning into a wetland and filling in their cove.
So they were creating their own lake problems and
didn't
even realize
it. So we got to be really careful that we're doing, because it not only does it affect just the water quality or the fish or anything else, but it really affects our impact and our use on our recreational waters.
What do you think, Jason? Can you sort of have it all under the Shoreland Protection Act? Nice view, the nice dock, the nice little beach?
I would say have it all, but the way the law is today, it does allow for a significant quantity of trees to be removed legally. You can certainly have the dock with the wetlands permit under different law, under wetlands law, and if the conditions are right, the possibility of a beach may be an option. The prescribed way to do that is to construct what's called a perch beach, which has a retaining wall of sorts around it, so it allows that sand to remain on the land rather than washing into the lake and requiring continual replenishment year after year.
Oh, that's interesting. A perch beach. That's the first time I've heard that that term, but I can picture it.
Sure.
Do you want to jump in, Tom?
Sure. I think there's an interesting balance that we're trying to strike the reality is that when people build homes and roads and rooftops and driveways and communities around lakes, water quality degrades. It's a historical fact. And so how do we have these kind of freedoms, if you will, these rights and property? And frankly, you know, the agency, the DES, recognizes people's rights to the water. It's captured in law. So the question is, can we find balance? Can we have enough access, whether it's visual, whether it's physical, without accelerating the aging of the lake? You talked earlier, you said something about slowing things down. I think Jeff had referenced this. As we slow things down in the landscape, what we're trying to do is slow the aging of the lake down, which is otherwise accelerated by the activities of people around lakes.
Never mind polluted and, you know, not nice to.
Well, that's, yeah, aging of the lake is a euphemism for it gets richer in nutrients.
Yeah, which sounds good, but it's not.
And we also recognize that lakes are very different. They're all different from one another. And a lake rich in nutrients might be a great fishing spot. The question is it the activities of people around the lake, which is accelerating that process, or are people living in such a way that slows that stuff down, lets it soak into the ground? Even heated water from rooftops, from driveways, from roadways is having an impact. So it's a matter of striking and finding that balance.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? Because, you know, we all love to be by lakes and rivers.
Indeed.
It's lovely. It's relaxing. In the summertime, you know, nothing's better than to jump in. But the more we get close to them and love them, we're possibly hurting the quality of the water that we love so much.
Yeah, indeed. It's an expression that's been used before. But you know, we can indeed love them to death. We've shown through time that can, in fact, be the case.
Let's go to our listeners, gentlemen. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking once again at the Shoreland Protection Act, spelling out how landowners can develop their property alongside lakes, rivers, and other water bodies. We're hearing about the act, the goals, how it's worked over the years, and some of the problems. Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Leonard sent us an email. He says, I live on a small 135-acre pond. Several homes on the pond have added fresh beach sand to refresh their waterfront. I see nothing wrong with this, Leonard says, yet the Shoreland Protection Act expressly prohibits it. It does no harm to the pond, yet the town has installed culverts that take street and rainwater and drains directly into the pond, roads that are heavily salted in the winter. Why isn't that prohibited? Leonard, it's a great question. Thank you so much. And Jason, I'll turn to you first, but want to hear from everybody. You do hear complaints about this that, you know, very strict for people who live right on the water body. But what about all those sort of upland uses like roads that Leonard mentions?
Sure. First of all, when we're dealing with beaches, the Shoreland Protection Act actually doesn't regulate beaches. Beaches are considered to be regulated under wetlands law because they are directly on the shoreline, and there is it's a bit more difficult to explain on air, but in essence, they're not regulated by shoreland law.
That's so weird.
It is. There's an overlap.
I mean, a beach is on the shoreline.
Sure, there is an overlap in jurisdiction. Any impacts to the water body, the bed of the water body, or the bank, is actually jurisdictional under wetlands law.
Maybe after a short break, I'll give you a chance to talk more about what Leonard raises.
Sure.
Again, those sort of upland uses, roads, heavily salted. He's right in the wintertime because nobody wants to slip and slide off the road. But how those uses affect the water and where the Shoreland Protection Act comes in. So, Leonard, thanks a lot for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. So coming up, we'll talk more about that. Also, we'll hear from a longtime resident and citizen scientist in Sunapee. She's been collecting samples from the lake for a long time, so we'll get her perspective as well. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A on NHPR. We're bringing the show to New Hampshire, and we can't wait for you to join the conversation. I'll lead a distinguished panel of guests through a special discussion about issues that matter to you and to the Granite State. We'll be at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord on Thursday. Get your tickets right now at ccanh.com. See you there.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's another look at the Shoreland Protection Act. The law spells out how landowners can develop their property alongside lakes, rivers, and other water bodies. It's been on the books since the early 90s, but can still create controversy and confusion. Let's get you into our conversation. If you live near a lake or a pond or a river in New Hampshire, what do you see around you in terms of water quality and development along the shoreline? What do you think are appropriate restrictions? What feels like too much to you? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Jason, just before the break, I was giving you a chance to respond to Leonard's concern. He feels like the restrictions on beaches on his pond are too tough. On the other hand, he says the town doesn't restrict, you know, sort of water running off from the roads and being dumped in the pond as well, and the roads being salted in the winter.
Sure. Just a touch on the beach piece. Under wetlands law, sand can be replenished up to 10 cubic yards every 6 years with the wetlands permit. Through that permitting process, though, DES is looking at the construction of that beach and making recommendations on how to better retain that sand on land in the future. Land-based activities that occur, the Shoreland Protection Act is looking at impervious surfaces. Certainly,
that means, you know, pavements where water is not allowed to soak in.
All those surfaces that can't absorb a rain event, and so really, all land-based activities do pose some threat or harm to water quality.
So not to get too technical on the air, but, you know, I've read, again, people making the complaint that Leonard makes. How far back do you go? I mean, if I live, I don't know, a quarter of a mile from a big lake or an eighth of a mile from a big lake, I'll turn to you first, Jason, but anybody jump in. Does my land usage get caught up in the Shoreland Protection Act? If I don't live right on the shoreland, but I live close by.
Sure. Great question. The Shoreland Protection Act extends 250 feet landward, roughly from the water's edge.
That doesn't sound like very much.
It's a fair amount.
Yeah.
But it's also important to recognize that the Shoreland Protection Act isn't just a law that's looking to protect trees. The Shoreland Protection Act is looking at like I said a moment ago, impervious surfaces, those surfaces that can't absorb stormwater, because impervious surfaces have the tendency to concentrate stormwater, which in turn has negative impacts on water quality. So looking at it, that area of 250 feet through the lens of the Shoreland Protection Act, we're looking at getting a better handle on our impervious surfaces, and also in addition to keeping a well-distributed stand of trees, but better managing the stormwater that is associated with those impervious surfaces.
Do you want to jump in, Jeff?
Yeah, well, I think that we don't want to miss the important point that because of the steepness in the lands around our lakes, anything we do, as I said, on any of that landscape that's a contributing area to runoff is going to have an impact. It's just that the shoreland area is the last area in terms that we can catch it. And we are dealing with, there are laws that, there are stormwater laws and different types of drainage laws and things like that impact developments away from the shoreland. The most critical thing is that everything we try to do, we're trying to minimize the creation of this runoff volume. We're trying to minimize the flow. We're trying to spread out so that it can actually get back into the ground before it gets to a receiving water. And so that's what we're looking at. But if you're a shoreline property and you're getting drainage coming off of the road that you're on, and you have a driveway or that goes into a boat ramp, you're essentially giving it all that stuff that's generated above you a pathway to get into the lake, and that's definitely not good for what's going on.
A little bit later, I want to ask all of you how much development, roads as well as homes, is grandfathered into this law, because there's a lot of old homes, and I'm thinking of a lake that I go to every year, and there's a road right by the lake. So I want to ask you guys about that in a moment. But I also want to go down to the lake level in our conversation, and let's bring in Midge Eliason. She's been working on Lake Sunapee for many years. She's a resident there, longtime citizen scientist, steward of the lake, where she's been collecting water samples. And Midge, really nice to have you. So you've been testing Lake Sunapee's waters for a little more than a decade now, is that right?
Yes, thank you, Laura. I have been taking daily samples for a little more than a decade, but I've also been involved in another monitoring program that actually Jeff Schloss started years ago, and I've been doing that for maybe 20 years.
Wow.
That's
so
a monthly sample.
Daily samples. So I'm picturing you, Midge, you know, cutting a hole in the ice and yanking out your sample.
June through October.
Okay.
Not
all
in
right.
the winter. I wish I could do that.
So what are you looking for, Midge?
Well, I'm part of a big scientific study that's been run through the Lake Sunapee Protective Association, LSPA's research director, and it's looking at the presence of a cyanobacterium called Gliotrichia in Lake Sunapee. And it's trying to figure out what influences the growth of this cyanobacterium. And in order to do that, we really found that taking weekly collection wasn't enough. We really need to know how this presence was fluctuating from day to day.
And cyanobacteria is the nasty stuff that can make you sick and you can't use the lake if there's too much.
That, you know, can create a green scum, and, you know, there's a lot of research into what its health effects are. But, you know, it's not a sign of a healthy lake when it gets out of balance, which is what's been happening on many of our lakes.
So what have you found about Lake Sunapee in terms of cyanobacteria?
We found that the cyanobacterium has actually been present in Lake Sunapee back into the 1840s. They've looked at sediment from the lake bottom to figure that out. And but it has been more prevalent over the past 10, 12 years than in the prior years. And we're trying to figure out why it's out of balance.
Yeah, so there's been an increase in cyanobacteria, and that sends shudders down the spines of not just residents of New Hampshire, but people who work in the tourism industry, because our lakes are so important,
important
for tourism.
Yeah.
So what have you seen, Midge, in your years on the lake and studying the lake in terms of shoreland development?
Well, it has obviously increased. There's been a sort of aesthetic change as little summer camps that are sort of, you know, cut out of the woods have become much more substantial year-round houses. And there's been an aesthetic change in the kind of landscaping that goes on along the shoreline. You know, it used to be that you sort of cut a little path down to a dock and a little view, and now it tends to be a lot more sort of wide open, broad lawns, big granite staircase steps down that are impervious, that kind of change.
So how do you feel about that? I mean, you sound disappointed, but we're talking about the Shoreland Protection Act. I'm wondering why the Shoreland Protection Act doesn't prevent these big giant lawns that, you know, can involve,
you know,
runoff and geese, which are a source of cyanobacteria. Yeah, go ahead.
Excuse me. I think that the Shoreland Protection Act really attempts to keep that kind of change tamped down, but I'm not sure it's really observed. I think that there is a lot of sort of creeping change that, you know, is not necessarily permitted, or, you know, it's sort of, well, if I just cut down one more tree on my property, it's not going to make any difference. But
and who's going to notice?
The cumulative effect of that attitude makes a lot of change.
Wow. So what do you want to see happen, Midge?
I'd like to see the act more enforced. I'd like to see, you know, I think that's a very difficult thing for DES. They do paperwork processing, but they aren't on the lakes. It falls back to the towns. The towns have various levels of ability to go out and actually see what's happening on the land. And too often, you know, things sort of go along a little unchecked.
You know,
people don't like to rat on their neighbors, but the cumulative effect is sort of this creeping development that's beyond what the Shoreland Act hopes to see.
I have read, Midge, that after the legislature dialed back the Shoreland Protection Act, that some lakeside towns amped up their own ordinances. What about your town?
I would say definitely. I have property in both Sunapee and New London, and I think they have both tried to sort of fill a gap and keep things, you know, a little tighter and a little more controlled. But they also do not have the manpower to watch what's happening.
All right. Midge, it's been good to talk to you. Keep an eye on that lake for us.
Thank you very much, Laura.
All right. Bye-bye. That's Midge Eliason. She's a resident of Sunapee and, as we heard, a longtime citizen and scientist and steward of the lake. Let's hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And before I go back to our listeners, Tom, I want to hear from you. Really kind of striking to hear from Midge, worried about cyanobacteria in one of New Hampshire's most beloved lakes, Lake Sunapee.
Thank you, Laura. First, I just want to give a shout-out to Midge and the many, frankly, thousands of people like her around New Hampshire, both the local associations, but all the volunteers. New Hampshire really relies on people who love lakes and who spend countless hours, as you've heard, monitoring that and trying to educate neighbors and influencing public policy outcomes. And so that gets to the advocacy piece. And frankly, in all due respect, with a 424-person legislature, the environmental standard is the most, it's going to be dialed to the degree which 51% of them can agree. And so we think that that is often a standard that's insufficient to protect long-term water quality. And that, frankly, the short-term economic returns of business interests prevail.
What did you think about what she said? You know, there's maybe not whole-scale, obvious infractions of the Shoreland Protection Act, but little nips and tucks here and there, you know, maybe a tree cut down or a driveway widened and nobody wants to rat on their neighbor.
I think she's exactly right. That, frankly, we don't think that the results of the standards as we now see them playing out in the landscape are sufficient so that, in fact, not only the grandfathered lawns, where we the grandfathered properties which have manicured lawns, but frankly, the vegetative buffer around lakes is being nibbled away to the point where water quality is degrading. And I don't know the exact results of this year's monitoring, but my understanding is that the cyanobacteria and bacterial and algal bloom outbreaks alone are starting to trend upwards pretty significantly. So is the Shoreland Act, in the way it's being enforced and complied with by landowners around lakes, adequate to protect water quality? Currently, we think not.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Jeff, what about you? What jumps out from that phone call that we just had with Midge? There's a lot there.
Well, yeah, I think it's very interesting. In fact, not only in Sunapee, but this summer we've had blooms of Gliotrichia, that specific species of blue-green bacteria, occur in Lake Winnipesaukee in a number of areas and in other lakes of New Hampshire. Our research group, along with Dartmouth, actually found that species of blue-green bacteria actually does contain toxins that it wasn't thought to have. So it has those same sort of things that we're concerned about when we see a blue-green bacteria bloom. They look more like little bubbles in the water than they do a bloom, but they can have a negative impact on public health. I think it really goes back to the landscaping again. As we try to turn our lake shores into what we're used to in a more suburban area, what we're doing is we're getting away from the naturalized vegetation that essentially can take care of itself pretty much. It doesn't need to be watered. It doesn't need to have additional nutrients. As we start trying to grow something like a Kentucky bluegrass, which is great for Kentucky or a golf course, but not necessarily the best thing for a shoreland property, it does attract lots of goose if you like geese, but other than that, it doesn't really do much. And so what the concern there is that you're putting down nitrogen, you're putting down all these modifiers to the soil to try to get something that's not natural to grow. And it's that nitrogen and that phosphorus that have a big effect on when and where we see these algal blooms and blue-green bacteria blooms.
Let's take some calls. And Nancy's calling from the Monadnock region. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for your show today. You've given me a lot to think about, especially the runoff from the road. I hadn't thought about that. But my question has to do with non-invasive species in terms of pickerel weeds and lily pads. And if the pond is getting shallower, what's our option for removing those lily pads so the pond flows smoothly?
Oh, okay. Nancy, I'm not sure if that's Shoreland Protection Act per se, but do you want to jump in on that, Jeff?
Well, it really depends upon the pond or the lake. Remember, we have a situation where most of the lakes in New Hampshire are enhanced by a dam, and so they were originally either wetland or, in some cases, they're actually farmed lands that we've kind of flooded to enhance the size of the lakes. And in any kind of natural situation, even small ponds try to go back to what they originally were, which could be a wet meadow or even dry ground. So it's not uncommon to see encroachment from these what we call emergent plants. The thing to think about, though, is that what's allowing that to happen a lot more is when we get all that material in, especially the sediments coming in, we're essentially making those shallow areas even more shallow. We're putting down more organic matter for those plants to take advantage of that.
I see.
And we're increasing the potential for growth. When we disturb an area, we tend to see cattails or other types of emergence come in. So that's what we need to be really careful about. The more we can limit the material that comes down into those lakes or ponds, the slower that process is going to be. But as Tom mentioned, there's a natural aging process that's going to eventually make lakes more productive. And part of that increased productivity is more of what we call the little fringe or more of those emergent plants coming
up. Yeah, productive has a positive connotation. But in this instance,
we're increasing the speed of that.
Yeah, I see. So as more stuff runs off, it creates a more beneficial environment for those plants that Nancy doesn't want in her water body. She wants it to run more clearly and freely. Nobody likes it when a lake gets sort of mucky and all that. So, okay, Nancy, well, thank you for the call. And let's go to Jerry in Freedom. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
I'm Jerry Kunerk. I'm a state representative from Madison, Freedom, Tamworth, and Albany. And that's a place, of course, where the lakes are very important to our quality of life and also to our local economy. And I've also served as the chair of the board of Green Mountain Conservation Group that works toward water quality. I really am concerned that the Shoreland Act is just not sufficient. People view the fine of clearing their land as just the cost of doing business to be able to clear their land and have that nice big green lawn that goes down to the water. I think there's a couple of things that could be considered. One is using cease and desist orders when somebody starts doing something, but another thing would be to have a more robust penalty, such as accumulating fines till it's remediated, or perhaps even that the state would just move on in and remediate it when somebody has cleared an area and then bill the landowner to pay for the repair that was done.
Well, Jerry, I'm glad you called because we should talk about enforcement. And Jason, you're right here. So he's saying, look, if somebody's wealthy enough to build a big old house with a big old lawn,
sure,
the fine is not really that big a deal.
Yeah, we hear that often, that folks and developers will just pay the fines associated with the enforcement piece and be done with it.
And so then the big lawn remains? Because that is a problem for water quality.
That's not the case. It's a bit of a misconception. Is through the enforcement process, what we first do is if impacts have occurred that do not meet the minimum standards, the department seeks to have those areas restored, and restored to the minimum standards, and we request that the property owner developer retain the services of a professional, maybe a licensed landscaper, to submit to us a restoration plan for the department's approval, which then requires yearly monitoring. We do have the ability to also impose administrative fines if the violation is egregious.
Okay, so there's more robust enforcement than perhaps the question implies.
That's correct.
Okay, and this is the second time this has happened to you, so I'm going to let you pick it up after a break, Jason. So, Jerry, we'll talk more about that after a break. Got a couple emails, too, including one from someone who says that the Shoreland Protection Act should stay as it is and municipalities should not impose additional requirements. So we'll cover all that coming up. Let's hear from you, too. You can join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, we sit down with New Hampshire Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando. Send us your questions for Director Normando in advance of the show if you'd like. exchange@nhpr.org. And then be sure to join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, we're revisiting the Shoreland Protection Act, aimed at keeping New Hampshire's water bodies clean, but still the subject of some confusion and controversy. Let's hear from you on this. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. So, Jason, just before the break, we heard from Jerry in Freedom, who said he feels like the Shoreland Protection Act isn't followed closely enough, isn't tough enough. He said, you know, people just build these big lawns and take the fine and then, you know, happily go out and play in their lawns the next day, basically. Sure. And you were saying, not so.
No, that's not the case. And what I was saying was is that, you know, the department's first approach is to get a restoration plan from the property owner or developer to show us how the certain areas will be restored to the minimum standards. I also wanted to touch on, you know, starting from Memorial Day weekend, we receive hundreds of complaints throughout the summer. And what we're finding is oftentimes what folks perceive to be a really egregious, significant violation of the Shoreland Protection Act, turns out that the folks actually did obtain a shoreland permit and the project occurred as permitted.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
A great example is looking from, say, a bird's eye view of the property, as the Shoreland Protection Act is written today, 75% of the area that exists, say, from 50 feet to 150 feet landward can be clear-cut today. And from afar, that looks really aggressive, and it appears to be a violation of the Shoreland Protection Act. Turns out it's not. So a new home could be constructed, a new lawn can be constructed, provided it doesn't encroach closer than 50 feet to the water's edge. You may see a new lawn, all very permissible under the Shoreland Protection Act today. Looks aggressive from afar, but is often very legal.
What do you think, Tom?
Well, see, in that instance, what someone has done is taken that 25% remaining vegetation and split it in half and left a 12.5% visual barrier on the sideline. And this is where they have virtually 75% of the property.
Okay, wait. Lots of numbers. So can you just explain that a little bit more?
The property ends up looking
ABC
like a manicured bowling alley, as I mentioned earlier,
yeah,
where the remaining vegetation is strictly on the sidelines and at the center part of the property, and often on very steep slopes.
So is that bad?
Certainly, because then you don't have this roughness associated with the natural shrubs and forest buffer that's going to slow water down and let it infiltrate. So these roadways that are back of the property, you know, on the outside of the property, that may contribute water through the property to the lake, aren't slowed down as a result of that. So that vegetative buffer is what we're trying to retain. So when we talk about enforcement, a big part of it is that the laws and the standards might work and do work perhaps when the spirit of those laws are met. If people are trying to figure out a way around them, like so many laws, then we end up with this bowling alley, if you will, where people have still met, quote, the standard. So we strongly encourage, New Hampshire Lake strongly encourages municipalities, local communities to take matters into their own hands. If they value their lakes that much more than, say, a statewide legislative process will set, then determine those standards for themselves. So we work very aggressively locally to help people do that.
That's interesting. I've got an email to that point that I'll share with you in a minute. But Jeff, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
I just want to say something. We seem to be pounding on lawns. There are kind of good lawns and bad lawns. The lawns that we don't want to see are the ones like the 100% Kentucky bluegrass, where there's really no benefit that we're getting and we're having to put down high amounts of nutrients and actually add water to the system. There are lots of different fescues and rye and things like that.
What's a fescue?
Different types of species of grasses that are mixes that are specifically designed for this area, that are low maintenance, that can be grown and are fine as part of the landscape that would be on a shoreland property.
Okay, and spoken like a landscaper who knows what you should plant and what you shouldn't. But to your point, Tom, about municipal ordinances versus the state laws, we got an email to this effect from someone who says, you know, he doesn't think municipalities should be putting in their own laws. Roger says, I serve on my local zoning board. The Shoreland Protection Act, he says, allows municipalities to be more restrictive than the Protection Act provides for. Given that the Protection Act is comprehensive and based in science, Roger says, what is the rationale for allowing municipalities to be more restrictive? So, Tom, your thoughts first, but anybody else can jump in.
Well, sure. I mean, the way it works from a statutory standpoint is that it's enabling legislation and under which, and along with many other parts of law, cities and towns can enact more restrictive ordinances. This is their right to do. And I think the thing with the Shoreland Water Quality Protection Act is the standards, I would respectfully disagree with the caller or the emailer, that, in fact, they are having the desired effect. If people meet them in a way that they also understand how they're protective of water quality and have that same vision or that same intent, perhaps they can be sufficiently protective. What we've seen in reality is that removal of vegetation is occurring in such a way that complies with the letter of the standards of the Water Quality Protection Act, but are not protective of water quality. It's plain and simple. So the evidence is pretty clear on the landscape. And we just simply say that towns have the right to, particularly, you know, you take a town like Wolfboro, 30% of the tax lots have waterfront property. Those tax lots provide over 60% of the property tax income. So how the lakes go, so goes that town. And that's only one of so many towns that are highly dependent on clean lakes and the economic values associated with that.
So respectfully disagreeing with Roger, who feels like the Shoreland Protection Act is good enough and should not be supplemented by the towns, you'd say, I disagree with that.
Correct.
So to the point about towns having their own ordinances, and I have read that a lot of them do, does that make your job, Jason, more difficult to sort of explain what this means to people?
No, it doesn't. Working for the department, you know, our duty is to enforce the provisions of the Shoreland Protection Act as it's written today. Certainly in our outreach efforts, we make an effort to educate everybody, all our stakeholders, to make them cognizant of the fact that some municipalities have much more stringent standards.
Do most of them? What's your just perspective on that? Do you think half of them do or a third of them do? Or?
Oh, I'd say much smaller, maybe 10%.
Really? Okay.
If that, yeah.
But some of the big ones like Wolfboro, that's a lot of people and
not necessarily the big ones, but it seems the more progressive municipalities that seem to recognize the value of their water. And they feel that they need to provide a greater level of protection to these resources.
All right. Well, Roger, we appreciate the email. Thank you. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Debbie in Laconia. She says, we have dozens of ducks and Canada geese living on the lake. Given the amount of excrement they produce, why are there no attempts to eliminate or at least limit the number of them on our lakes? And Debbie, everybody wants to jump in. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, that was one of the points I was making before in terms of what happens when you clear the land. When we had this natural shrub and forest buffer on the shoreline, the interesting thing, especially about geese, which are probably the most efficient bird to pack waste that I've ever seen, if you've ever been on a lawn where there's even been a small amount of them. Actually, you allowed for most of your shoreline to have higher shrubs on that shoreline water interface, geese won't come up onto a property if they can't see over the vegetation.
And oh, that's interesting.
You can actually keep them from going onto a lawn by just planting a shrub buffer. And you don't have to make it continuous. You can actually alternate it so that you can actually walk through it by zigzagging. But you could actually, you don't have to put any chemicals down. You don't have to do anything. You won't get geese if they can't see over the shrubbery because they're afraid of being poached from both sides, from the water side and from the land side. They're not going to come up on a property. And that's probably the most simplest way to keep those types of birds off your property.
That's fascinating. So plant a couple bushes and you get rid of the geese.
Get some high bushes in there, except for where you want to have that path to get down to the water, and you're not going to have geese coming on your lawn.
Wow. And geese has been a big problem in recent years, right, Tom, for New Hampshire lakes? I mean, people complain about this all the time.
Sure. And whether it's increasing or not, I'm not sure. I know that any open water that we have, Canada geese, essentially a domesticated variety, will stay put. But to Jeff's point, you know, one of the things I talk about with lake associations and individuals all the time is mow less. Start with the concept of mowing less, and that is to figure out what kind of plant communities, what kind of species of grasses, whatever they may be. What if you had to just knock them down once a year just to maintain it like you would a hayfield? You can still maintain pathways, particularly if they're in a circular or, you know, curved fashion. But that, by mowing less, you're going to keep the geese at bay. And you're also going to reduce that runoff.
Well, and you'll make the bumblebees and other pollinators happy. On the other hand, a lot of people worried about ticks these days. And to eliminate ticks, we're told, you know, give your lawn a crew cut every 5 days.
Well, there may be some trade-offs. And I wouldn't suggest that people need to accept ticks per se. But there's a number of products that we can use, whether it's on clothing, whether it's on footwear, how we dress, to prevent that. But the idea of creating some type of sterile landscape adjacent to the water is simply counterproductive.
Yeah, and you'll end up killing the lake.
Indeed.
All right. Well, Debbie, thank you for the email. Here's another one from Barbara in Sunapee. Does the state set guidelines or regulations for use of road salt by towns on roads the lake rings? A little confusing there, Barbara. I have lived on Lake Sunapee since 1962 and have witnessed significant water degradation and an exponential use of road salt on the lake road. It is very distressing to see so much salt dumped daily on the roads during inclement weather. Let's just use sand, Barbara says, on low-use roads. I've wondered about that, too. And, Jason, I'll turn to you again. I go to lakes all the time, but there's one in particular that has a small road literally right on the lake. So what about the idea of salt and sand and so forth?
Sure. They exist. They exist everywhere. The Shoreland Protection Act actually doesn't regulate the application of salt to roadways. We do have a watershed assistance section that works with municipalities in reducing salt loads to roads. We also working with municipalities to better manage our gravel roadways. Often they too are very, very close to water bodies. We're looking at regrading them and managing them in a way that better allow stormwater to get infiltrated in ditch roadside ditches, et cetera, and get into wooded areas rather than discharging it into surface waters.
What's the grandfathering provision, Jason, of the Shoreland Protection Act? You know, those roads that have been there for a long time, those houses that have been there for a long time.
Right.
This act was only put into place, you know, almost 30 years ago, so it's been a while, but boy, we've been living on our lakes forever here in New Hampshire.
Sure, great question. The law is very clear in that all of those old cottages, old homes with existing open areas and even lawns that extend right down to the water's edge, those are considered grandfathered open areas. And under law, they can continue to be maintained as they have historically. If a developer or new property owner comes in and they wish to develop that property in a way where they may add increase levels of impervious area. That's the word we were talking about earlier, the surfaces that can't absorb stormwater.
Sure, pavement, roofs,
That's when the law has a restoration mechanism in it, in that the law says, okay, if you have this small old cottage here that's down by the water's edge and this lawn where there's no longer any trees and you want to build a new, larger, more modern year-round dwelling, the law says that's permissible, but you need to make it what we call more nearly conforming with the law. And how do you do that? You plant more trees. You plant more saplings by the water's edge. You maybe update the old septic system overly close to the water, as well as incorporating some stormwater management features to better slow down and intercept stormwater to get it to retain it on land.
Tom, do you want to jump in on that too? A lot of these lovely houses along the lake, especially those, you know, old classic cottages, have been there for a long time, long before the Shoreland Protection Act.
Yeah, indeed. Some would argue that the majority of shoreland property is already developed in some fashion. I don't know how that percentage actually breaks down. But frankly, that's where we think is the greatest opportunity. And what we're focusing on is making sure there are sufficient standards, both at the state and the local level with the Shoreland Act, for future development. But frankly, working with landowners to try to reverse that and have them, in fact, restore, not just by, you know, because the statute or laws might influence them, but through education and resources. And that's our big push, frankly, from an organizational perspective, is working with folks to provide them with the tools and the incentives to do so. There's great programs in the country. Maine has this Lake Smart program where people can actually mow less, even install, blueberry bush sod, so you can restore visually, aesthetically, and functionally this vegetative buffer. And that's our big focus, and where we think that existing lands that have been developed can be returned to a more protective condition, if you will, of water quality.
Right, and we've been talking about how, you know, some people violate the law, maybe on purpose, maybe not. But bottom line, probably, Tom, from what you see, is everybody wants to protect these lakes.
Indeed.
It's not that people are, you know, flouting the law and thinking, ha-ha, I hope I can pollute my lake today. I mean, everybody wants to take care of these things.
Yes, we don't look at this as an adversarial thing. It really is about information, identifying how things work and getting people on the same page. So working with the landscape industry, working with folks who are developing lakefront property, working with landowners themselves, and we think if it's done smart, it can be done right, it can be done well, and we can continue to protect this tremendous asset that we have in New Hampshire's 1,000 lakes.
Well, here's an email from Rick that came in from Meredith, who says, I have lived and worked in the Lakes region for 45 years. Like many programs in New Hampshire, the Shoreland Protection Act will never achieve its objective until its enforcement is properly funded by the state. So, Jason, that's for you.
Well, he's right on the money. After all, laws without enforcement are just good advice, right? And our staffing for enforcing shoreline protection is pretty limited. We only have a handful of full-time staff that are devoted to protecting or enforcing the Shoreline Protection Act. We triage hundreds of complaints throughout the summer. We do our best to act on those that pose the greatest threat to the environment and public health.
Okay, all of you. We might revisit this in another year or two and see what's been going on. Jason, it was good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Jason Obie, Shoreland Program Outreach Coordinator with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Tom O'Brien, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Tom O'Brien, President of New Hampshire Lakes. And Jeff Schloss, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Jeff Schloss is Natural Resources Chair at UNH Cooperative Extension and co-author of Landscaping at the Water's Edge, An Ecological Approach. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.